Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby. Mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa. Take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Ch-ch-chumba. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This is a view from the bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
The Watchers of Göbekli Tepe. That's this week, straight ahead on A View from the Bunker.
Spiritual warfare is where the rubber meets the road for us as Christians, but often we treat it as though it doesn't really exist. Well, during the month of November, we're tackling this subject head on as we celebrate the release of Sharon's new novel, The Poisoned Pawn, Book 8 in the Red Wing Saga, a series that teaches spiritual warfare through compelling stories featuring characters that you come to know and love. As part of this special package, we're offering the important new book by our friend Vicky Joy Anderson, They Only Come Out at Night, where she looks at the phenomenon of night terrors or sleep paralysis, examines what the medical community says about it, and then digs into the spiritual forces behind it and the good news that there is a way to make it stop. We're also offering our two-disc DVD set, Unmasking the Ancient Gods, a series of presentations on spiritual warfare, everything from the UFO phenomenon to Jack the Ripper and spiritual warfare in the 19th century, which is really where the storyline of the Red Wing Saga begins. Bought separately, this package is worth $65, but it's yours for just $35 plus shipping and handling during the month of November only. Our spiritual warfare special offer, available only at our online store, gilberthouse.org/store. And as always, we thank you for your prayers and your support.
Scientists and researchers like to convince us that they know pretty much all there is to know about just about everything there is. That's why we keep hearing phrases like, the science is settled. Ain't necessarily so. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. This week, we're going to talk about one of the most mysterious sights on planet Earth, one that we hope we see before another year has passed. More about that later in the program. We'd have been there already if the situation around the Black Sea had not gotten so dicey this year. Anyway, our guest has written a book about this, and he's written it from a Christian perspective. It's a site that archaeologists have called the world's oldest temple. Okay, as a Christian, we have to ask the question, who was worshipped there, and why, and how? Oh yeah, and why was it ritually buried? Our guest has been involved in a number of important archaeological excavations, including the, expeditions, including the search for the Ark of Noah and the discovery of the 12th Scroll Cave at Qumran, where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. Is the author of a number of books, the new one being Guardians of Göbekli. We're honored to welcome back to the program Dr. Aaron Judkins. Aaron, it's good to have you back on the program. Haven't had you here since you and your colleague on your Petra documentary shared with us the brilliant term travelogumentary, which we have stolen. Of course, we give you credit for it every time we steal it and use it, but because that describes what we put together for our tours of Israel. But we're hoping we can do a couple of those next year and maybe even get you involved in one of those. Because Göbekli Tepe, one of the places that we had planned to see already, as we're recording this, we would have been just coming back from Turkey if things had gone as we'd originally planned this year, but maybe pushing it off another year. Give Russia, Ukraine, Turkey, that whole region a chance to settle down a bit. But having the opportunity to absorb your research and having talked privately with Judd Burton about the things he's working on, boy, we really want to go now. And I'm going to tell the viewers that we got your email as you were announcing the release of your port. This is essentially like a sneak preview of the bigger work that you and Judd are working on together.
Right.
We read it on the plane on the way home. We got word of it as we were at the airport in Louisville. And so bought it while we were at the airport and read the PDF on the flights home that day. So this is some fascinating stuff. For people not familiar with Göbekli Tepe, other than the name, what is it and why do you find it so interesting and important?
Well, thanks for having me on again. It's been great. And yes, I'm looking forward to that trip in Turkey to Göbekli Tepe next year.
Yeah.
Göbekli Tepe is an ancient archaeological site in southeastern Turkey. And this supposedly goes back 12,000 years ago to the pre-pottery Neolithic A time period, the Stone Age, if you will. And so this particular site has caused a lot of investigation and basically research into what is going on at this particular time in history. Because what we thought we knew about the Stone Age is, in a lot of ways, changing what we know. What I like to repeat from my colleague, Dr. Judd Burton, who said, this is the paradigm that is changing the paradigm. That is absolutely true. He nailed it when he said it like that. Because what we know about Göbekli Tepe is not what we've been told that has happened through an evolutionary process of civilization. As a matter of fact, we see exactly the opposite.
To give people a sense of where this fits in the time scale of history, and we're using the dates that professional archaeologists use because that's an easier way to just, okay, we'll agree on these dates, even if we, with a biblical worldview, maybe we don't really agree on those dates. Fine. This roughly constructed about 9,000 years or so before, say, Stonehenge.
Some say about 6,000 years, give or take a few thousand. Mm-hmm. But that's generally the conventional timeline of where we're at on the grand scheme of things. It's 6,000 to 9,000 years prior to Stonehenge in England. So this site is definitely one of the earliest sites that's in a megalithic architecture that we know of.
This was at a period in history when experts believed that human civilization just wasn't this organized. And yet, as you point out in your second chapter here on sacred architecture, these people were moving blocks of stone that weighed anywhere from 10 to 50 tons
right
from a quarry, even moving it just a quarter of a mile. I mean, that's a lot of weight. I mean, a fully loaded 18-wheeler on our highways is 22 tons. That gives people some sense of scale what we're talking about here.
Right. Supposedly, Stone Age people who had no organizational skills could, barely get together and, hunter-gatherers, right? They were not able to come together in an organized fashion to create, a division of labor on the scale. It's totally mind-boggling to understand just exactly how difficult this is to erect this particular site over a 22-acre site. It's an extremely large area of an archaeological site. In Israel, we call it a tell. This is a tepe.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the same, it means the same thing, a hill. So Göbekli Tepe means literally the translation is a pot belly hill or a pregnant hill.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is what we're seeing in the archaeological record, this megalithic architecture created in a organized fashion with a division of labor by people who were supposedly before writing and the invention of the wheel.
Before the wheel.
So. Yeah, exactly.
So they weren't putting these slabs on really big carts and rolling them around. They were having somehow to drag these into place and set them up.
Yeah, that's the premise of what we know.
And somehow you're able to organize this these work crews who otherwise would be out hunting for game, maybe doing some basic early agriculture or defending against rival tribes that might want to come and steal your stuff or your women.
Well, and, you know, it basically comes down to the question of who were these people and why were they there?
Why was it so important to do all of this work?
Exactly.
Because you're not getting anything out of it. I mean, building defensive walls, that's one thing. Okay, you get something out of that. Protection so we can store our stuff and keep it away from our enemies, or we can dominate the people around us and make them give us stuff, whatever. But this is strictly a ceremonial site. And before we get too deep into this, the 22 acres, I mean, I've got an idea of how much land that is. We got about 10 out here in the Ozarks, but that 22 acres is only a small part of the total site, right? That's just the 22 acres that have been excavated, or am I confusing that?
The 22 acres is the total site.
The total site, okay.
Right, yeah. Only about 5% of that site has been excavated.
Okay, all right. I thought I remembered that only a small portion of this had been excavated, but I also remember reading that Karahan Tepe is similar, which is, I think the author of the piece that I read about this a few months ago called it stupefyingly, mind-numbingly big. And Karahan Tepe may even be older than Göbekli Tepe, but I digress. Anyway, so you've got this site only 5% excavated, and just even that 5% of the 22 acres has provided some tantalizing and intriguing hints at what was going on back in the day. So why did they erect these big T-shaped pillars with these mysterious carvings on it? What was so important about this site that would make them spend all of that time and energy and effort to putting it together?
Right. Well, that's the big question. That's what everybody wants to know. That's why this site is mysterious in a lot of ways, because it goes against an evolutionary chronology of how civilization occurred. That paradigm says that people organized together, they came together, they built cities, defensive positions, they came together, strengthened numbers, they were able to then settle into an area that provided these civilizations that had access to food and water. And then as a society began to grow and to build, then you have religion that forms as a result of all of that. Göbekli Tepe says, no, this is not how this happened. It's exactly the opposite. We see a religious ideology emerging from the stones of Göbekli Tepe, people coming together in a religious form of context before civilizations are actually developing into other areas like Karahan Tepe or Catahoulic or Nivali Chori, a lot of these other places, but especially like in Jericho, is one of the earliest cities that we know of, is fairly contemporaneous with Göbekli Tepe. It's a pre-pottery Neolithic B, and we do see in Jericho that they had a fortified position with a tower and a wall that was some 13 foot thick. So we do know that there was this culture that was emerging, but the big question is, why were they there and what they were doing? And so what I try to do is answer this question of Göbekli Tepe from a biblical perspective. Where does it fit in the Old Testament, and how does it relate to the biblical narrative of the history of what we see in Genesis? So it gets down to a very opposite paradigm, the paradigm that is changing the paradigm in a religious context. They were doing something very specific. Why they basically took all this trouble to build this site, an area that they didn't even live at.
That's the thing that's really startling, is that this site, this 22-acre site with all of the tools for processing grain, you mentioned in your early chapter here the number of grinding stones that were found for the processing of grain. But to this point, archaeologists haven't yet found a residential quarter. Now, maybe that's in the other 95% that hasn't been dug up yet, but you'd think if people were living there, with the amount of work that went in there, you would have found the huts or some sort of dwelling that was close enough to allow the workmen to get to the site, move these big stones, and set them up to the place, and do all the artistic carving and so forth. That was one of the reasons, by the way, at Gilgal Rephaim, the big megalithic site on the Golan Heights, was recently redated from the Intermediate Bronze Age, which is where it was placed originally, to the Coccolithic, about 3750 BC, a combination of two things. Number one, it optically stimulated luminescence, where they checked like quartz grains from underneath the central core, but also because there aren't any Bronze Age sites close enough to Gilgal Rephaim to allow workmen to get to the site and move all that stone into place. So you would assume with all of the work that's been done there at the site, the amount of man hours required to move that stuff, that they would have come across some evidence of dwelling somewhere within a reasonable walk of Göbekli Tepe, and that just hasn't been found yet. So,
no, it's not been found because I don't think it's there. Now, as you said, 95% is still under the ground. It took about 10 years for them to excavate one enclosure. That was enclosure D. 10 years. So at the current rate of excavations of twice a year, you're looking at about 150 years to excavate this site fully. So it's going to be beyond our lifetime probably before we know what is under the ground there fully. But what we do know is actually revealing, and I think probably there is a chance that we may find homes. There is later rectangular structures that's at the site of Göbekli Tepe. Now, these T-stone columns that we're talking about are some 20 feet high. They're a T-stone column. So they have this T-shape, and they're anthropomorphic. And there's two central of these T-columns, stone T-columns, that are in these enclosures, and they're facing each other. And then you have smaller T-columns around there and in this circular enclosure. And so I don't think the evidence is pointing to that they actually lived there. They came there for a specific purpose. They were there perhaps for a time or a short season, and then they left. So where did these people go? Where did they come from? I mean, you have the ancient, you know, city of Ur, which is about 9 miles away, modern-day Shanlurfa. And so it's in a reasonable distance to walk there. And then you have, other areas around Göbekli Tepe that are very similar in architectural style with these T-column and anthropomorphic, even zoomorphic images, this symbology, this imagery that we're seeing in the Stone Age. It's all telling us a story. So what I try to do is kind of zoom out from all of that at a 35,000-foot view, if you will, to see what's going on in the area, because we like to focus in on Göbekli, and that's what this book is about. But if you take a little bit more of a broad survey of the time period and the region, I think we have a fairly solid answer on what's happening at this particular site.
And that's one of the things that really intrigues me, because this overlaps with the research that I did for the Second Coming of Saturn, because this is the same territory when we start tracing that character the Romans called Saturn back through history. His point of origin is somewhere in this vicinity. The Hurrians called him Kumarbi, and you can trace his origin to this general area, Urkesh, which is the ancient Hurrian city, one of the first, probably the oldest known Hurrian city, and these are the biblical Horites, is a little southeast of there. Just across the border into what is now Syria. But that region generally, I mean, that's, you know, Haran is very close by, where Abraham came from. Sanliurfa may be where Abraham came from. I suggest in my book that maybe Urkesh is where Abraham came from. But there's some specific terms used in the Hurrian of that region and of the river that runs through there, the Balik River, that have very definite religious connections to the underworld. And I know that is like this chapter 3 of your book. You get right into this with the sacred ancestors. So what story are you seeing when you zoom back out and you look at the overall region as a whole and try to piece that together with the imagery from some of these sites? What is the story?
Right. Well, we like you said, we take the what we know from that area. And this is the ancient area of Haran, where they worship the moon god Sin.
Right.
And this goes back millennia. And so if we extrapolate that back a little further in time, back to Göbekli Tepe, I think we're seeing imagery in the stones themselves that is indicative of ancestor worship and deification of ancestors and spirits represented in zoomorphic forms that serve as guardians. These T columns serve as guardians, but in particular, there's another guardian there at the site that that's a deification of something that they are doing there. They're actually coming together for a specific purpose, and I think it's to in a ritualistic, ceremonial way to perhaps worship the moon god. Now, we don't know exactly, you know, what this god is called at Göbekli Tepe. We don't know if it's, you know, the god Sin or if it was a different god, a lunar god. But the imagery that we know of, perhaps on two of the main columns in enclosure D, is pointing to a lunar deity. Hmm. And this is exactly what we see in other area sites that were worshiping a lunar deity moon god. And then we see it, you know, from the 7th century forward in the religion of Islam,
yeah,
who have the image of the crescent moon and the offspring of the stars. We're seeing the crescent moon imagery and the bull imagery at Göbekli Tepe on the columns. And of course, we know that over at Çatalhöyük and a lot of these other places in the region, the Neolithic people were known as people of the bull.
Hmm.
So this is taking us back to a time period where this people are coming out of a very catastrophic event. Matter of fact, not just one, but several catastrophic events. I think it's probably post Tower of Babel and the dispersion, but they're absolutely there for a particular reason, and we have evidence of ritualistic feasting of the area in the plain of Haran that has the wild emmer and einkorn wheat and barley. We know that they were taking these grains. They were actually fermenting the barley in big stone vats.
Can't have a party without beer. Yeah.
Right.
And even so, 12,000 years ago.
Right. And so we have evidence of feasting. We have evidence of a fermentation of the barley in beer. And so they're actually coming together with these big enclosures, and there's multiple enclosures. There's not just one. There's multiple in these enclosures. But I think they were doing some things there that probably perhaps was deifying one of these ancient gods that we know of, and that historically what we know is the lunar god, the moon god, Sin.
Sin was called the frisky calf of heaven later in Mesopotamia. Now we're talking about 7,000 years down the line. I mean, the writings that we've got from ancient Akkad and Sumer. So, and they didn't really develop writing, at least as far as we know, until about 3000 BC. So from 3000 right. BC onward, we've got texts that will describe the moon god Nana in Sumer, Sin to the Akkadians and Babylonians as the frisky calf of heaven because of the crescent moon shape of the horns. But the aurochs, the giant strain of cattle that was present in, all over Eurasia at the time, they're trying to recreate it by crossbreeding larger strains of domestic cattle now in Europe. What could possibly go wrong there? These things stood 6 foot tall at the shoulder. I mean, I know you from Texas, you know what a longhorn is like, but we've got a lot of cattle here in Missouri too. But these things are huge. In fact, I saw the program you did with Dr. Michael Heiser on his Fringe Pop 321 program, you and Judd talking about the aurochs. And the imagery of the bull was something that really struck me in researching my book, Last Clash of the Titans, because the very name Titan, according to scholar Dr. Amar Anus, derives from the name of the old Amorite tribe, the Tadanu, which in turn comes from the Akkadian word for aurochs. So this tribe, the Titans of the Greeks, these old gods, were named for this strain of cattle, which is really interesting when you compare that with Ezekiel and his description of the Kerovim. Okay?
Right. Yeah, precisely. I talk about that in the book as well, because you're right, that these giant auroch bull cattle, they're not domesticated. They're wild.
Right.
And they were huge. It probably took a multitude of men to hunt one of these animals down. I think these animals were, you know, they represented strength, the power, the deity, the power of over the earth. And so, you know, when you took one of these giant aurochs down, that, you know, that's meat, but that's status.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so, just like we see in the imagery of the lunar god later on in history, in the Sumer, as you said, he was worshipped as a god, not an Akkadian. He was the moon god Sin. And so just like they're doing with the deity, I think they've deified the image of the bull because of the imagery that they were seeing in the constellations. And this goes back to the description of the man and the bull and the eagle and the lion
mm-hmm,
that's in
mm-hmm.
the constellations.
It's not a coincidence that those four aspects of the cherub were also the four cardinal points of the Babylonian astronomical sky. I mean, the four quarters of the sky were defined by those four
images. And so I talk about that in the book because there's an imagery here that's being played out in the deification of not just the lunar god, but an actual image of the cherubim, of the cherub that fell. And of course, we know this image as the image of the bull, the face of the bull.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you're looking at the general context of Göbekli Tepe, we have in a particular enclosure, and I think it's enclosure B, we have these stone vats with grooves, channel grooves carved into them. They're for libation purposes.
And so
we see that these images are set up in the central part of the enclosure. We think that probably they had roofs over them,
mm-hmm.
and that they came before these images. A couple of different reasons. One is to deify the ancestors, or their ancestors were remembered, venerated through these stones, where their spirits were represented through these stones. Or perhaps they were paying homage to the Rephaim.
Mm.
And so we see in context, we see a religious purpose. We see a separation of rooms that are for sacred space, and we see rooms that are for other. And so anytime we see a sacred space, we see terrazzo-type floors. There's evidence of plaster at Göbekli Tepe, which I talk about in the book. There's no evidence of a ceramic pottery because this is pre-pottery.
Yeah.
However, they, I think, had other things at their disposal. We certainly see the stone tools there at Göbekli Tepe with over 3,000 grinding tools found at the site. So if they're grinding the wheat and they're coming together for this ritualistic feasting with a water source that's some 3 miles away in today's time, then they were there for a specific purpose. And with the enclosures, with what was happening, the deification of the lunar image on the stone column and the bull image, this is very indicative of a religious ideology in a very, very early form of a religious context that we know of, and that's all happening here at Göbekli Tepe.
Hmm. So a 22-acre site that, at least based on the evidence we have now, specifically created for religious purposes, not as a residential site that also had a religious function like cities, in the ancient Near East, where you've got a city with a central temple location on the Acropolis or whatever. This was specifically for ritual purposes. And the question is then, again, because they didn't have writing at this point, or if they did, they didn't put it in the stone, which was awfully inconsiderate. There are other clues, though, that something else was going on here at some of the nearby sites. And again, pulling out to the 35,000-foot view, you mention the skull building at Kayanu? I'm not sure how to pronounce the Turkish name for it. I remember reading not long ago about that building, but also about the Çatalhöyük. Okay. You mentioned of the 350 burials there, 18 of their heads removed a year after the initial burial of the body. We also know from contemporaneous sites like Jericho. Yeah, just do a search online, viewer, for Jericho skulls and see what you turn up. It's really, really weird. Apparently, there was something going on with the heads at the skull building in Çayanu. It appears that the removal of the head was based on the stained altar on which that was found at that building. The heads weren't removed after death. They were removed while the victims were still alive. So what was there a skull cult going on in this period in history?
Yeah. We're not sure. We think there's a good possobility that that's happening at Göbekli Tepe too. Now there's not any burials found at the site, as is with Kayanu and some of these other places. We do know that the Natufian culture buried their dead, mm-hmm. and this is the culture that I think it plays a part at Göbekli Tepe and at Jericho, that the Natufians. They buried the dead, and they were known for this particular skull cult. It's probably...
Yeah, we've okay. We dropped out for just a moment there, so you could kind of pick back up maybe 15 seconds and just pick up, and I'll edit it together.
Yeah, so there's no evidence of burials at Göbekli Tepe, but we do know that there is skull fragments at the particular site that was deliberately placed in these enclosures. There's fragments of these skulls that have holes drilled through them, and there's etchings on it as if they had been cut with a flint knife. And so it all begs the question, why were there skulls there but no bodies?
Yeah. And what are the holes in the skulls for? Were they wearing them like little necklaces? Or?
Well, I think it was for probably... for veneration of these people. And so what they would do is, if this is the case, you don't need the whole body. You just need the skull. You bring the skull, and perhaps they drilled holes in the skull or fragments and hung them up, in these enclosures. Now we don't know that for sure, but why would you have holes, that are drilled through the fragments of bone for none other of the purpose of hanging them in some kind of a ritual ceremony? That's the only thing I can think of that makes sense.
It wasn't tree panning to do something surgical. Basically, these were holes that were enough to thread through a string or a piece of leather or something.
Right. These holes are post-mortem. And so it actually, there's actually evidence of sky burials. Now, again, this is all circumstantial and conjecture, but we do know that particular to this culture that they had sky burials, and so they would bring the dead bodies, and then the birds of the air, the vultures, etc., would come. And there's a particular concept with these animals, for instance, that the birds were seen as spirits. They represented spirits. And so the spirits would come and take the flesh and basically allow that spirit to be released up into the heavens. That's the general idea behind the sky burial. Now, we don't know for sure that they were doing this at Göbekli Tepe. That's one of the theories, one of the working theories. is that they were performing sky burials there. They were bringing their dead and then doing that. But why wouldn't you have more evidence of bones if that's the case? You only have fragments of 7 skull fragments at the site. Not really enough to say that that is a purpose for sky burial. Not really enough to say that they were performing, you know, these rituals that involved sacrificing people, but certainly ritualistic feastings. There's plenty of evidence for feastings and the stone vats of beer that they had.
Mm-hmm.
And so this area of Haran basically supported all that agriculturally. This is before agriculture, actually. This is wild barley and wheat. So this is before agriculture. But if you have the natural resources around you, then that's where you go to get the food. You know, and so perhaps they were appeasing the ancestors with, you know, these particular ritualistic feastings. Perhaps they were deifying their ancestors or appeasing the gods in particularly. And why, you know, why wouldn't you, if you believe in a power over the heavens and the earth? I think this shows that these particular people at Göbekli Tepe had a religious ideology that came first before agriculture. They were aware of a spiritual level that was beyond them. They were aware of not just a terrestrial plane that they were on, but a heavenly plane, and then a plane that was below them, a spiritual awareness. And I think perhaps that when you put all this together, that they were actually a number of reasons why they were actually coming to these sites. Perhaps the lunar deity served as a way to have, you know, power over the other gods, power over the heavens. So when you do need, you know, agriculture that came forth in the summer, in the you had these feastings that came together in the summer and fall equinoxes, that, you know, they come together, you harvest the grain, you have all these stone vessels that were used to grind the wheat. You have evidence of all kinds of flint tools there. But keep in mind that Göbekli served over some period of time, some say over a 1,000-year period. We just don't know for sure. What we do know is that these people came together and they were there for some time, and then they left. They didn't stay there. There's no evidence of living there full time. There's no homes there like there is at, say, Çatalhöyük. There's homes with these giant auroch skulls with the big horns. They're actually hanging. Their homes are underground, and they have these skulls that were actually plastered, that were hanging on the walls of their home, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And so you would see 3 or 4 different of these giant auroch skulls with the horns. And again, does it go back to status or does it go back to a deification of this animal? But we do see that at other places surrounding Göbekli Tepe. And so they were there and then they left. But why they were there and what they were doing there, I think, served a very remarkable purpose into probably perhaps the lunar god that we see later on. Perhaps this is one of the earliest forms of deification of the lunar god and the image of the bull that we're seeing.
Yeah, yeah, that's really interesting, because one of the aspects of the lunar god seen, his numeric representation in the logograms of the Sumerians was the number 30. And because of the 30-day cycle.
Oh, that's right. 2, 3 X's.
Yeah, yeah, because of the 30-day cycle of the moon. Now, of course, it's not specifically or exactly 30 days, but that also relates to, there's a fertility cycle connected with that monthly cycle as well. And so you've got that aspect of it besides. If this is connected to the center of the moon god cult in Haran, which was one of the two main centers of the moon god in ancient Mesopotamia, the other being the city of Ur in southeast Iraq. Interestingly, Jericho, named for the Amorite moon god, Yerik.
Yeah, that's right.
So, you know, the Israelites made that their first target crossing the Jordan River, interestingly. But if you connect Haran to this ancient worship of the the bull god or something that looked like something supernatural that had a bull aspect to it, like a cherub.
Right.
Things get really, really interesting.
It gets interesting now because we're seeing the face of the cherub in imagery that we've never seen before in the image of the bull.
Yeah.
And you have to know something about the Maseroth, and you have to know something about those constellations and the four points of the heavenlies that paint that picture. And it's all lined out biblically in the book for that. And I think that's probably, when you get down to it, you know, Satan wants worship. He wants to be worshiped as God. And so we see this after the fall, after the flood. You know, you go from Genesis 1 to the creation to Genesis, you know, 11. And, you know, everything's wiped out in the flood. And then they're having to come back. And basically, you know, they get wiped out back to the Stone Age again. They just get technologically reset. And where do you start from? You're just back to the Stone Age.
Mm-hmm.
And so this Natufian culture is emerging from the flood. I think they are hunter-gatherers. There's evidence of that. And then, you know, they're trying to survive. They're coming together. One of the first places they come together at is at, Nimrod builds a Tower of Babel. And then they get dispersed. So I think this is perhaps past the dispersion after the Tower of Babel, because this is you know, an area that people are actually beginning to scatter from that region, and they're going and, you know, worshiping and you know, kind of doing their own thing. But as you said, there's no evidence for writing here. However,
yeah, I was going to get to the however.
Yeah, let's talk about the
because this was one of the things Sharon and I found most exciting as we got down to about halfway through the book. You go into the possible connection to logograms used by another group of people that occupied this part of southern, what is now southern Turkey, southeastern Turkey, people called the Luwians, Luwians, and I've also heard it pronounced Luwian. So, Luwian is correct.
Right.
Okay.
Luwian.
So the Luwians, really interesting for a couple of reasons. I think they're part of the channel through which the old memories of the gods of Mesopotamia were transferred to the West, to the Greeks and the Romans. But you, on page 122, you've got a list of Luwian logograms with the Latin transliteration and the English meanings, the English translations below those. You connect some Luwian logograms, which, again, roughly in the same geographic area, although thousands and thousands of years later, the Luwians were contemporaries with the Hittites in the second millennium BC. So 2000 to 1000 BC, the Luwians were occupying southern Turkey. So we're talking a long, long, long time after Göbekli Tepe. But there's some really interesting connections.
There is some connections. That's what really leaped out to me when I was researching this. I actually caught it on this imagery that's on the top of the T columns. Again, this is anthropomorphic, so faceless, but they have arms wrapping around the sides with fingers wearing some kind of a belt and a loincloth, like a fox pelt loincloth in the front. These are anthropomorphic. But on the top, right about where the neck area is, there's imagery. We talked about the bull imagery already. And then we talked about on the other one, there is imagery of a crescent, which represents the moon, and perhaps a disc representing the sun or the full phase part of the moon. And so logograms are basically, they're words, they're symbols that represent words. And so the Luwians were neighbors to the Hittites. They were categorized in the Bronze Age. They're way past the time frame of Göbekli Tepe. However, the symbology, the same symbology that we see there in Luwian logogram or the Hittite, which they labeled as Hittite hieroglyph. They labeled that wrong, incidentally. And then they caught it and realized it's not Hittite hieroglyphs, it's Luwian. which these are symbols that represents words. So one sign represents a word. So it's not written language. However, I think it does represent an idea or a concept that goes along with language. So, for instance, on the belt loincloth of one of these central stone T column, it's in enclosure D, you'll see what looks like to be some H's, like the letter H, and some C's, or a backward C, which is like a parentheses. And you'll see this on the side part of that belt. Now, when I first looked at that, I thought, that's not a belt. It looks like a belt, but that can't be a belt. It is a belt. And it's just, it's clearly a belt with this fox loin pelt on the front. But this symbology on the side of it is very interesting. So when I saw that on this YouTube video, that I had never seen that before. And I had to take a close look at it. And they don't really give you a clear look at it. But as I began to go back and try to find imagery of what this was, I realized that you have an image of a bull on one. You have the crescent moon on its back with a full disc on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have kind of this H-looking symbol on top of it.
Yeah.
That's not really an H, but that's kind of what it looks like when you're seeing it. And so these Luwian logograms that are much later in time have direct meaning in what those represent. So in other words, in one of the imageries that we see at Göbekli Tepe is the Luwian symbol for Deus, D-E-U-S, which is the
Deus.
Latin
yeah.
for God.
Right.
And so it's like a parentheses with a line and another parentheses. You'll see that on one of the columns. It's not one of the big central columns. It's a smaller column, but it's at Göbekli Tepe. And then you have this I symbol, this H, that's kind of turned on its head in the form of an I. And that, I think, is a Luwian logogram representing a house. Now, some say that this particular H or I symbol, it doesn't matter which way it's standing. It's what it represents. And it's representing either a house or a gateway.
Hmm.
So I've heard both ways. Now, Luwian logogram suggests a house,
mm-hmm.
but it could represent a gateway too. So that's what the Luwian logogram for this particular era of the Bronze Age represents. So why is it in the symbology at Göbekli Tepe, that supposedly thousands of years before the Luwians ever existed? Why do you have this same idea of the representation of Deus in Luwian logogram that's depicted at Göbekli Tepe? So, in other words, these particular people, I think, were there for a particular reason, but it was in a house that they had considered a sacred space. Now, some people call that a temple. I don't know if you can call it a temple, but you can call it sacred space and sacred architecture. And that's one of the chapters I get into the book, is why they had this imagery there. And then you have these other imageries that are around that actually, I think, is telling us probably what they were doing there. It's not written language per se, but I think it is a representation of words, which is language. I think this art, this symbology, this ideology written in stone is telling us a story.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I'm looking at a picture of that pillar 18 as you were describing it. And I encourage people to get a copy of your book to see exactly what it is you're arguing here. This is fascinating stuff. I guess the bottom line here is, coming back to something I asked earlier, why would prehistoric man, who presumably had something better to do with their time, at least in terms of productivity, hey, we could learn how to grow this wheat that grows naturally out here. Maybe there's a way we could figure out how to make it grow a little more efficiently and regularly and keep the weeds out. And or maybe we can, domesticate these big cattle out here so that we don't have to go chase them down all the time. You know, can we build enclosures for them? Are there ways we can do other things instead of spending hundreds and hundreds of hours I think the amount of time that it took at Gilgal Rephaim, which is a smaller site. I mean, it still involved moving like 42,000 tons of stone, but I think they calculated something like 300 man years to build it. I mean, like one guy working 8 hours a day,
right.
300 years.
Right.
Now, obviously it was not just one guy who built that, but the point is there was a lot of energy expended and a lot of work that had to be directed, and somebody who was controlling the design and the layout, which meant that this had to be really, really important at this point in human history, at that particular place on Earth. Who directed it? What were they trying to achieve? Who were they trying to impress?
Yeah, I mean, we see the Tower of Babel event where Nimrod sets himself up as a god, basically. And they come together in a religious context. We're going to get back at God. We're going to build this tower. And as you write in your book, which is I reference in this book,
and thank you for that, by the way. Thank you.
Very frequently, by the way, because it all ties in, as you said earlier. And I think some of those key things that we understand at Göbekli Tepe can be found in a broader context of what's happening that you write about in your book that I reference in there. But these particular people, I think post dispersion, had this sense of, we've lost paradise. We've lost the Garden of Eden. They certainly, I think, knew about Adam and Eve and the Garden of Eden. And it's a way to try to connect this axis mundi of reconnecting themselves with the heavens and the earth. I think they realized that, and I think it served perhaps as a gateway to we need to try to get that connection back that we lost. And I think perhaps there's a greater answer here at the purpose of Göbekli Tepe, not just at Göbekli Tepe. That's not the single site. This is a whole region.
Right.
As we said, as you said earlier, there's a site that they say is older than Göbekli Tepe called Karahan Tepe. There's Çatalhöyük, which comes later, that perhaps had thousands of people living at this particular site. It is the largest city of the Neolithic that we know of. And then there's Jericho, which is one of the earliest cities.
Mm-hmm.
But we have other sites that actually worship the moon god. It's very similar in architectural style with imagery of the zoomorphic animal imagery, a very similar style and structure, architecture that we see in other places. That's why I take kind of this 35,000-foot overview to see what's happening in the area, because Göbekli Tepe is not the only site that's actually happening at. There's other sites, which means that this culture is connected. These people are connected. It's the same people. It's the same culture. So I think they were trying to reestablish the lost connection here in a spiritual sense, and they were doing it through worshiping the face of the cherub, unfortunately, and the deification of the moon god, which we see later on, and then perhaps other deifications that we see even later. This may be one of the earliest depictions that we know of in imagery of a deification of a god. And this all ties into this Genesis 6 theme of the fallen angels and Mount Hermon and the work that Dr. Burton has done. Hopefully we'll get all that and we'll put it into a single manuscript in a book that's forthcoming. We see sudden catastrophic events happening. This is a post-flood. I lay out why this is post-flood, not before the flood. Now, there are different ideas for that, but I think it's post-flood because of the limestone blocks that, you know, these giant megalithic stones that they used are limestone. That's all post-flood. So if you want to know something about, you know, where this all fits into the Old Testament, I think between laying the foundation for why it's post-flood, why it fits into a particular area of the book of Genesis, and the purpose of what they were doing, I think this really shows this is really indeed something that we should take a closer look at, because what's happened in the past, we're doomed to repeat it.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, and this is what we're seeing now in the end times. We're seeing a deification in this worship back of the ancient alien gods and those gods who are expected to return. And yeah, it's not going to be any big surprise to anybody now because
we've been conditioned for it
for so long that you know we were seeded here from life on other planets. That is not true.
Right.
So we get into a kind of a wide swath in this book about the whole thing. But if you want to know something about the not only just the Neolithic and the Stone Age, but the whole thing, it's referenced in over 200 footnotes. I mean, if you read the footnotes alone, you're going to read a whole nother book in there as referenced in many of your books, Dr. Heiser's books and others. So it's heavily referenced.
And I look forward to following some of these because, again, as you say, this is part of a region of sites that all date to the same period of history. And Karahan Tepe, and I know you mentioned this here, you get into a lot of iconography of characters with six fingers, which also, by the way, turn up about several thousand years later in the vicinity of towards the Dead Sea.
A very surprising find. It kind of took me back to even see this in the literature. This is in the literature. People have noticed that there's been anthropomorphic images with six fingers on them. Not only Göbekli Tepe, but a couple of other sites.
Karahan Tepe,
right. So this is documented in the literature. This all goes back to Genesis 6 and the tie of what they were doing and how this all rolls into Göbekli Tepe. But I think it's important to if you want to know. If you want to know where all this fits, and if you want to have a general understanding from a biblical perspective, I think this is the first book that's putting forth that answer, because all the other books that have been done on Göbekli Tepe come at it from kind of an evolutionary point of view. I think this is the first book that's actually come out that's tried to fit Göbekli Tepe in a chronologically biblical Old Testament time frame, which is very, very difficult to do, by the way.
Yeah.
It's almost like a can of worms, to be honest with you. You have to know something about the flood and Tower of Babel and the Ice Age and carbon dating and to really put all this together. So all that legwork is done in the book for people who are very interested in, hey, who are the guardians of Göbekli?
I look forward to having more conversations with you and with Judd about this as we go forward, because this, as he said, and as you cite, this is the paradigm that breaks the paradigm. This was not supposed to be within the capabilities of our Stone Age ancestors. And yet, not just this site, but a number of other sites, archaeological experts of the government of Turkey announced this about a year ago, September, that they found at least a dozen other sites in the general vicinity of Göbekli Tepe, all around the plains of Haran, which is where Abraham left to come to the Promised Land. And I don't think that's coincidental either. And again, this character who was in my most recent book, Saturn/Kumarbi, who I believe is Shemiyaza, the leader of the Watchers, this cult that followed him, you can trace back through history to this general region of southeast Turkey and northern Syria. So there's a reason for that, and it continues down to this day as the New Agers and globalists believe they can bring back a golden age when...
This all ties in. It's eerie how it ties in. I never thought that I would... do a book on Göbekli Tepe. I was challenged to write this book about 3 years ago, and I said no about twice, and then I said yes after the third time. It's really a difficult book, but it's one that had needed to be written. I think there's still a lot more that we don't know about the site. As it moves forward with archaeological excavations, we'll know more. But what we do know is absolutely changing everything. It's a great book. And I really encourage people to take a look at it.
I agree completely. Again, Sharon and I read this on the flights between Louisville and getting back here to the Ozarks. And did you see this? The Luvians are in here. So that was really exciting. So, yeah, it all fits together. And as we try to piece together the timeline of history to better understand the plan of salvation, nothing that Jesus did was by accident. And this... is another piece to the puzzle. And we look forward to continuing to work on this because I think, well, again, 95% still to be excavated, plus a dozen other sites or more in the vicinity. There's a lot more information to come out.
There's a lot. Yeah. There's a lot that still needs to be uncovered. But I put a chronology time frame timeline in the back of the book, a chart, if you will. And so people can visualize this where it's on the time frame from the Masoretic text and the Septuagint. And you can kind of see where the timeline at Göbekli Tepe fits. It's not exact, and I'm not dogmatic about those numbers at all, because they can be adjusted, I think, still. But it's very, very close within, I think, probably within a couple of hundred years in the grand scheme of things. It's pretty close, I think, where the time frame of Göbekli Tepe fits into the biblical narrative.
Fascinating stuff. Where do people get a copy of The Guardians of Göbekli?
AaronJudkins.com. It's going to go out on Amazon, but I don't think it's quite there yet. But AaronJudkins.com is where you can go buy it directly right now.
All right. Aaron Judkins, AaronJudkins.com. Look forward to talking with you again sooner rather than later. And hopefully we can announce some plans here for next fall to bring people to this location. And we'll talk more about that as we get closer to 2023.
That's right. Thanks, Derek, for having me.
There's a link to Aaron's website, AaronJudkins.com, in the show notes, regardless of whether you're listening to this podcast or watching it. And of course, if you're watching it at YouTube, God bless you. Subscribe and click the little bell for notifications so that you get an alert every time we post something new. But I implore you, as a backup, if nothing else, please, please get our free mobile app, because that gets you access to all of our video content, not just this weekly podcast, but our two broadcast shows, Sci Friday and Unraveling Revelation, plus our weekly audio Bible study as we go through the Bible chronological order, verse by verse in chronological order. And that is usually uploaded by about midday on Sunday. We're also uploading, as time allows, the archives from our old podcasts, PID Radio, going back to 2005, and the archives of A View from the Bunker, the audio archives, going back to 2009. This will include early interviews, our first encounters with people like Tom Horn, L.A. Marzulli, Mike Heiser, and many others. All of that on our mobile app, and because it is hosted by a Christian company, we will never be canceled. So, please, mobile app, gilberthouse.org/app. Coming up, well, let me tell you, Skywatch TV's virtual conference is continuing and will continue through early February. 90 days access from November 4th, this just a week ago Friday. And my presentation, kudos to the team. They took the presentation that I gave them, and I did a little post-production on it. I added in a few slides that you needed to see up closer, maps and things like that. But they added a lot of visual interest to it after the fact, and I am really happy about that. So, because we understand, you know, especially with the economy going the way it is, $95 for access to a virtual conference is not, you know, it's an ask, okay? Now, I can tell you, because I sit on the board, I am the secretary for the corporation at SkywatchTV.com. I see the figures. I know where the money goes, and it gets put back into the ministry, specifically Whispering Ponies Ranch and the work that's done there with children in foster care through our partners at Royal Family Kids and also Teen Reach, Teen Challenge, rather, which had their first camps at Whispering Ponies Ranch this past summer. So your support of Skywatch TV through the virtual conference goes to support, ultimately, it goes to support the work at Whispering Ponies Ranch and what's going on there. So that's what's going on. And really, there's a lot of value here because you're getting two dozen presentations from guys like Tom Horn, Joel Richardson, Pastor Carl Gallups, people that you know, but also some, you know, Dr. Micah Lake, but also some new voices like Kenny C. God bless him. We love that guy. Dr. Micah Lake. Dr. Igal German, founder of a new organization called the International Biblical Apologetics Association, which is desperately needed, Bible apologetics right now. So folks like that, Pastor Doug Van Dorn, who's a regular on this program, has contributed two presentations I'm really looking forward to. One, an astral prophecy and on serpent mounds. So great stuff. Plus, you get access to six feature-length documentaries from Skywatch Films for your $95. And again, the funds go to Whispering Ponies Ranch. find out more. And you still got the better part of the 90-day window to take advantage of these films. And again, as a virtual conference, you get to set the schedule. You watch what you want to watch in the order you choose to watch it. DefenderConference.com. DefenderConference.com. Virtual conference coming up in January from Hear the Watchman. I'll tell you more about that as I know more about it, but I have committed to putting together a presentation for Mike Kerr and Jeannie Moore of Hear the Watchman. And then in March, we will be returning to Israel. And Sharon and I are planning to go out ourselves just a few days early because we're going to do some video shooting for a project that is kind of bubbling away up here. Just some very interesting stuff that we've been led to this year about the geography of Jesus' ministry and the influence of the Book of Enoch. And I'm not talking about the Book of the Watchers now, the first 36 chapters. If you follow this program for any length of time, you're probably familiar with us talking about that. The Book of the Watchers, you know, the sons of God who saw that the daughters of man were fair, led by Shemaiah and Azazel or Azazel. Okay, yeah, that's had a big influence on the Bible. But beginning of chapter 37, the section called the Book of the Parables, or the Book of Parables, that's turned out to be really, really influential too. And then stumbled across research, or was led to research, indicating that it was written in the very same area that produced John the Baptist, Philip, Andrew, Nathaniel, Peter, and where Jesus was baptized and where he based his ministry. Not coincidental. So we're going to work with Rabbi Zev Porat on something up there. But anyway, the tour itself begins March 19th, runs through the 30th. There's an optional three-day extension over to Jordan. You can find out the details, get a look at the itinerary, and if you're still inclined, I know the time is getting short here, as we're only about 4 months out now, but you're still time to reserve your spot. GilbertHouse.org/travel. And again, if... how often did I say the word again during this broadcast? I've noticed that habit. I'm going to try to cut that out. Anyway, if things settle down just a bit, we are going to be in Turkey next October. Keep watching this space as details become available. Meanwhile, if you get a spare moment, leave a review at Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, Amazon Music, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Spreaker, Stitcher, or wherever fine podcasts are sold. Our announcer is the inimitable DC Good. And a view from the bunkers, a production of Gilbert House Ministries, released under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 4.0, mind you, international license. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.